Welcome. This is the Seventh Radio Podcast from Dr. Larry Robbins and Susie Robbins. I'm a medical neurologist, headache specialist with a vast interest in all issues medical and health related and psychopharmacology and psychiatry. Here with my co-host and wife, Susie Robbins, who is a social worker. You can reach us at the email, which is right on the site, headachedrugs.com. The email is doclarryrobbins@AOL, or you can just click on it right on the site. And we have a number of interesting topics today, but first an email from a listener. This is from Liz in the UK, and the gist is, Dr. Robbins, you've spoken about depression being a biological medical physical illness, and I do. I talk about depression and headaches and ADD being just like asthma or diabetes or high blood pressure. It's a medical physical illness. And the question is, since it's a medical physical illness, don't you think that medicines are probably more useful than talking to somebody? Now, it's true that you'd think that medicine might help a medical biological illness more, but it turns out not to be true in a variety of contexts where therapy, for instance, is just as useful. They have shown that serotonin levels are increased just as much 3 weeks after starting psychotherapy as after starting antidepressants. And clinically, the studies show that people do well with psychotherapy, they do well with antidepressants, and they do the best with a combination of the two. So that's what we try to head at, as opposed to just waiting for the depression to get better, which might take a year or two and ruin the person's life. There was an interesting study in women who have breast cancer, and they did psychotherapy in the form of group therapy once a week. And at the end of a year or a year and a half, the women who were doing therapy had less recurrent metastases. Their cancer state was better in general than women who were not doing therapy. So this mind-body function is very real, and we don't want to just rely on medicines. Any thoughts on that, Susie?
You know, one thought that I do have is maybe I have mentioned on the show in the past that I do work. Actually, I volunteer at a cancer center near our home outside of Chicago, and many of the women who I see there are battling breast cancer, and a few of them have actually said to me that they have given the therapy a try in terms of group therapy, getting together with other women also going through breast cancer, and for some of them, it didn't work. They weren't prepared to hear, you know, the stories and the hardships that the other women were going through, because it seemed to signal to them that what's happening to this woman is going to happen to me, and they had to stop.
And I think that's not unusual for group therapy, support groups. I'm leery of support groups in certain contexts. That's why sometimes I like online support groups, although there can be some goofy people in the support groups. But people with, in my experience with multiple sclerosis, for instance, will go, or Parkinson's, etc., will go to a support group and sometimes say one person was really inappropriate or another person was very severe, got them depressed. And there's pluses and minuses to the support groups. And group therapy in general, I think, is tough. It has to be picked right. It has to be picked carefully. If you have one person who's inappropriate, they can ruin a group. And I've seen that online. The psychopathology that we call it, the psychiatric illness that we see in individuals, comes through in groups, and it comes through online in groups. For instance, we've talked on the show about borderline personality disorder. Some of them are very narcissistic. Some of them become the victim constantly. And you'll see that in groups online, where a pain support group will, with a borderline online, the borderline will be making up all these stories that constantly, every week, their uncle is dying, their brother is dying, some horrible thing, and everybody who doesn't understand that personality will be rallying around them, and what it does is it wastes the whole group's time. Susie?
you know, getting back to just for a moment, talking about actual group therapy experiences, it tells me how important the group leader or the clinician who is actually guiding the group needs to be within a situation like that, where there might be somebody who's inappropriate in the group. That would then be the responsibility of the group leader to possibly have that person leave the group if they're not there for the good of the whole group.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. A trained facilitator, trained therapist to lead a group, because sometimes if you have people who are inexperienced, who don't recognize personality disorders, they can let the group be ruined, or sometimes they ruin it themselves. Susie, I know you ran groups before, and what was your weirdest experience running a group therapy type situation?
Weirdest? Well, I would have to say probably my scariest time was when I was leading a group of women who were actively working towards getting clean from heroin.
Go.
One day, two of the women became angry with each other over a coat. The coat was missing, and one of the group people thought that the other woman had sold the coat for money. In any event, I could see that there were some tensions rising, so I physically got up to sit in between the two of them. A few minutes later, one of them stood up and punched the other woman in the face, her glasses knocked off, and it was quite a sight for a few minutes until help came in.
That's a very tough group. I actually did run a group once for borderline personalities, co-ran it in the late 80s. But we had five people in the group, and they competed for who could be a bigger victim. And it was really a waste of everybody's time, because everybody was crying at once. And I see that actually play out online, where people are constantly a victim on a pain group, for instance, or any sort of support group online. But if it's a moderated group, if the moderator is good, it can really work online. Well, on another topic, I wanted to talk a little bit about vitamins, particularly vitamin D, and a little bit about folic acid and the controversy. But there was an article last week that vitamin D deficiency is common in children with irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. Kids with inflammatory bowel disease, it's actually fairly common. We see it quite a bit, and they were tested for vitamin D and they were low. But that's not surprising, because much of the world is low in vitamin D, and certainly as you get away from the equator and people aren't in the sun, and certainly in the United States and the UK, as you get away from the equator, we get more and more vitamin D deficiency, so that 96% of the people in this country tested are vitamin D deficient. You know, it turns out that vitamin D, if you had to pick one supplement, I think D would be the most important thing to take. And they keep increasing. Really, the expert mucky mucks in vitamins now say that after age 70, people should take 1,000 units, 600 or 800 units until then. But I think taking 1,000 units is a good idea for everybody, because it's not too much, unless you get 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 units a day, and even then, we don't want too much D, because it can build up in the liver. It's one of those what we call fat-soluble, A, D, E, and K, but A, D, and E particularly are fat-soluble, so they can build up in the liver. They don't just get run out of the body through the kidneys, but really 1,000 units is not that much, and some women, particularly with low calcium in their bones, osteopenia or osteoporosis, should be on more than 1,000 probably. But C will not work without D. Well, not C. Calcium will not work without D. So you have to bundle your calcium with D. Susie, I know you've taken calcium with D. What do you think about the whole situation?
You know, I learned about a year ago that I have osteopenia. So, of course, when you learn something, a situation that you have, you typically want to read up on it, which I have been doing. And so I have been increasing my intake of calcium. And what's actually very easy about getting that extra D is that many of the calcium supplements that you can buy over the counter at the drugstore already have the additional vitamin D right in the tablet. So I've not had to go out and buy separate D. I'm just taking my, I believe the brand I'm taking is Caltrate, which has the additional vitamin D right in the calcium tabs.
And I do usually recommend calcium citrate versus calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate, such as Tums, etc., tends to be more constipating, for one thing. And there may be other advantages to calcium citrate with D as well. But it's interesting that D has now been linked definitively to at least three cancers and possibly multiple sclerosis. You know, we always knew that the farther away from the equator, we had more MS. So I was trained in neurology in Chicago, and we had a lot of MS. We have a lot up here in Illinois, and it's a huge problem. And they always thought, well, what is it about getting away from the equator? It turns out that it may be, to some extent, vitamin D levels, at least certainly growing up. So taking vitamin D does make sense for a number of reasons, and it is holding up as far as vitamin D levels being low linked to certain cancers. On the other hand, we've gone back and forth on folic acid, which is important for pregnant women, and they're thinking about even putting it in the flour in the United States to it prevents certain birth defects if women are on folic acid when they get pregnant. It's really the first trimester that's crucial for folate. But we thought that since theoretically folic acid does some good things to protect the heart and from stroke, such as lower homocysteine levels. Homocysteine levels seem to be crucial in stroke and possibly heart disease as well, that taking folic acid prevents stroke or heart attack. And now they came out with the position paper where they looked at all the studies on folic acid, and they decided that it does not prevent strokes and heart attacks. So I know I take folic acid, and I have for years, and I'm rethinking. It's unlikely that I'm going to get pregnant anytime soon. Maybe I shouldn't be taking it. It is safe, and it didn't increase the risk for anything. But maybe we're just taking it for no reason. We've had conundrums like this with other vitamins, such as vitamin E, and I've talked about that on the show before, too, where vitamin E was the miracle of all miracles. For a long time, they thought, oh, everybody should take vitamin E, and all of a sudden, they discovered that it didn't really help prevent heart disease, and although it's still controversial, and vitamin E does some good things, it possibly does some bad things. And the story is not out on who should be taking vitamin E. There was an interesting story this week also about Botox. Now, Botox is used for cosmetic, for wrinkles. It's been used since 1991 for a variety of things, such as cerebral palsy in kids and severe muscle tension in the neck. And Botox itself has been remarkably safe. Possibly 8 or 9 million people have had it at least. Probably quite a bit more. I think that almost a million people have had it for headaches worldwide. And Botox, I think, has been the real deal as far as safety and effective. But there is some fraudulent Botox that is manufactured by one or two manufacturers in the country, and it was really designed more for research purposes, and it's something like 20,000 times stronger than regular Botox. Regular Botox that you get from the doctor really is quite safe. But a couple of doctors got the brilliant idea of getting this fraudulent Botox, which is super concentrated. It wasn't Botox, it was botulinum from another company. And they didn't dilute it right, and it led to not great results. Several years ago, one of the doctors injected himself and his girlfriend and another couple at like a little party, and they all ended up on respirators because of the fraudulent botulinum toxin. So, you know, I don't think it's a great idea for doctors to try to get it from other companies other than Allergan and Botox, which really has been safe. I've done a literature search actually on severe side effects to Botox, and they are remarkably less. What I believe is probably almost all the medicines that we use have more side effects. Susie, what's your thought about wrinkles and Botox?
Well, I've thought about getting it myself, which I have not yet, but, you know, I never want to say never. If somebody else wants to do it, I think it's fine. I think, like most things, it's a personal choice if you want to do it. Why haven't I done it yet? I really don't want to get on a merry-go-round, because I know when you do something like Botox, you have to keep doing it. It's not a one-time shot and that's it. You have to go back, you have to go back, and you have to go back. And I don't know if I want to get into that craze of having to worry about, oh, I need my Botox again.
Right. Now, you don't have to keep, you know, what happens is it helps smooth out wrinkles, but then they come back in 2.5, 3, 4, or 5 months. And you can decide not to. It's not like they come back worse, other than you're 4 months older. The big problem with Botox traditionally has been it's fairly expensive. The little vials, the real retail cost on the vials is about $487. So now a doctor doesn't have to use the whole vial for wrinkles, so you can get by with less, but it's still expensive. Now, on another front, there was an interesting article where they looked at a bunch of studies for what's best for depressed seniors. Now, this was looking at 8 previous trials, and seniors are generally over age 65, and we're looking at depression. And the question is, what's the best treatment? And they looked at the usual care, which is mostly taking antidepressants from family doctors or the person's regular doctor. Versus talk therapy with a psychotherapist. In general, the researchers found that the patients in the talk therapy did better than just given medicine, but the most positive results came from 2 of the studies where they used a combined approach with mental health providers working along with the primary care doctors. Susie, any thoughts on depression in seniors?
Well, I think what you've just said certainly makes sense. I wonder, for those seniors who might inherently be depressed or had been depressed from years before, that maybe for some, they still do also need medicine. I'm not saying everybody does, but and I'm sure that the talk therapy would be very helpful, but there have to be some seniors out there who would still also need medicine.
I think that we could spend hours on the subject. Some of the controversies or angles that I see in treating seniors who are depressed is that many of them won't go for therapy. Medicare generally doesn't pay. Most of the therapists are not Medicare providers in my experience. Maybe that's different in different areas. So, and for because of money and time and stigma and whatever, most people won't go for talk therapy or psychotherapy, so we're left with medicines. On the other hand, the medicines have their side effects, and people collect medicines as they get older. They're on something all of a sudden for Synthroid, for thyroid, they're on something for arthritis, they're on 2 blood pressure heart medicines, they're on this and that, and we're adding in antidepressants, and sometimes they're seeing a lot of seniors are seeing 3 or 4 or 5 doctors, and one of them's giving them sleeping pills that the other doctors aren't aware of. All of a sudden, we add in other medicines, and it can be a whole big over-medicated mess. So what we want to do is use medicine, but in a rational way, minimize medicine, get a balance, not over-medicate, and push therapy. The seniors, in my experience, who go for therapy do pretty well. And sometimes it can be really life-changing. Susie, any thoughts?
I'm just wondering if, for the seniors who do engage in therapy, that maybe part of it's just therapeutic because they're actually being able to engage with somebody. Because for so many seniors, they're lonely. They don't have friends around anymore. Maybe family doesn't live nearby. And that just being able to establish a new relationship, even if it is a therapeutic relationship, really, really adds something to their lives.
Absolutely. One situation I've seen therapy help is in extended grief, which we've touched on the show, where somebody loses a spouse of 40 years, and 5 years later, the person still is really not out of their depression, is still stuck. And I think that therapy and or medications is very helpful in that situation. Now, some people want to be stuck, and they say 10 years later that they're angry with everybody who tries to unstuck them. They're 80 years old. They lost their spouse at age 70. They're still down, very down and depressed and not very functional, missing the spouse. But they don't want to get out of it, and they're resentful of family members and professionals and doctors who try to get them out of it. But I think they're in the minority. Most people do not like feeling that way. Susie, any thoughts?
Well, maybe for some of these people that we're thinking of who are having a hard time with grief and or resistant to therapy and or medicine, granted, some of it is grief, but maybe some of it is some depression that is lingering, but that had been present prior to the change in the individual's life, and that it all gets kind of lumped together with grief.
Absolutely, that's a great point. It blamed on the grief, but or the loss, but it was actually part of a depression that preexisted. I think a lot of older folks are depressed. It's not treated all that aggressively sometimes. And I think the reasons for the depression are it takes a lot of courage to get older. You get a lot of medical stuff that is difficult, dealing with a medical establishment and feeling terrible. I think it's easy sometimes to be 22 years old. It's tough to be 82. Now, segueing on to a different topic, there was an interesting article on ecstasy, which is MDMA, being neurotoxic, even after one or two time uses. And ecstasy is a common club drug, more in young people. There's a number of drugs like ecstasy, but they get high off of it. And a lot of adolescents, a lot of people in their early 20s tell me that it's no big deal, that it doesn't cause any harm. But I think the evidence is building that it really can change the brain. It's not such a safe drug. To quote from the study, studies have shown that long-term or heavy ecstasy use can damage neurons in the brain and cause depression, anxiety, confusion, insomnia, and memory impairment. And we certainly have seen all that. But I think the bigger issue is drugs in general in young people. They don't tend to acknowledge how serious the consequences are, or if kids do, sometimes they'll say that they know there are serious consequences, but they never think that it'll happen to them. Same as driving fast or other risky behavior. Now, Susie, my co-host, has had experience with kids with drugs and working with high school kids with drugs. Susie, what do you think?
You know what I'm thinking about as you're talking about this is a situation that happened in our town about 2 months ago. And at least for a time, it's changed some of the feelings of the parents and kids in our town. And that is, there was an accident with there were five boys in the car. The driver and one of the passengers were killed instantly when their speeding car hit a ditch, or actually hit a tree. The boy who was driving had alcohol in his system. The passenger had been smoking marijuana. And so it's become a big issue in our community. Our parents allowing their kids to drink and or do drugs and just kind of turn an eye? Are we as aware of what's going on with our kids as we need to be? And also, I think it's really caused our kids to wonder, hey, what are we doing here? We've just seen two of our friends die. I think the way kids feel now is the way the kids a generation ago felt. And before that, hey, it's not going to happen to me. I'm okay when I'm driving. I'm careful enough. But seeing an accident and the tragedy that's happened, I think it does cause us all to look at it a little bit more closely.
Yeah, I think very well spoken. It's I think our generation, yeah, it'll never happen to me. What I do think that some of the programs do work better than others as far as drug education. What's always struck me is the graphic, real-life stories from parents who had their kid go to sleep after binging out on alcohol and woke up cold and dead, and listening to the dad talk about his 21-year-old daughter, or what happened at the frat house, or seeing the pictures of people who've crashed at 100 miles an hour. I think it maybe pictures hit home more than words sometimes with kids as far as consequences. Because when you ask them intellectually, they say, yeah, we know that this leads to bad stuff and people can die, but we know that they never think it's them. Actually, it reminds me of a poll taken of Olympic athletes a few years ago, and they said, if you could take this steroid-type drug and win a gold medal, but you'll be dead in 5 years, would you? And about 70% of the athletes said yes, they would take it, which leads me to believe that there's something in our brains when we're younger that says, oh, we're just going to live for now and not think about 20 years later, or that's so far away. Now, there was another study this week, interestingly enough, about bulimia, and they linked urban living to higher rates of bulimia. Bottom line was that living in big cities raises the risk of suffering from bulimia, but not from anorexia. This was out of a study by Dutch psychologists. And I've always seen bulimia as separate from anorexia, and the people tend to be a little bit different. For one thing, bulimia, from a medical standpoint, sometimes responds pretty well to antidepressants that raise serotonin, raising the question, is there a basic serotonin problem going on in bulimics, in people who purge, throw up, binge out, and then throw up? And with anorexia, antidepressants have been iffy. It can help underlying depression, etc. It doesn't always really help the anorexia as much. So maybe bulimia, as far as what's going on in the brain and the body, really is quite a bit different than anorexia, although very often they coexist in the same person. Now, bulimia and anorexia affect mainly girls and women. Both are linked with an obsessive desire to be thin. Anorexics, of course, eat very little, while bulimics binge and then force themselves to throw up or use laxatives and diuretics to get the food and the fluids out of their body. And while anorexia usually begins during teen years, bulimia can occur at later times. And what we see is sometimes bulimia goes off and on into the 40s, 50s, 60s. I think that there's a couple reasons why bulimia is more secretive. People are generally ashamed of their behavior with bulimia and they don't tell anybody. They can also hide it. They're not getting ultra thin. Susie, what do you think?
Well, I agree, of course, that with anorexia, you know, people are starving themselves. It's also very visible to anyone who would see somebody who has anorexia that they are very skinny. I'm sure we've all had this, been in the situation where we've been at a mall or a restaurant or someplace out in public, and we'll see usually a woman who looks extremely thin, and we may think to ourselves, wow, I bet she's got anorexia. The people stand out, even though the person with anorexia themselves don't realize how skinny they look and feel like, if anything, that they look overweight. Whereas somebody with bulimia, it is more secretive in that you, unless you know what the person is doing in the bathroom, they tend to be able to maintain their weight. They don't get down to such skinny levels, but they have other health issues that occur with the purging. And I'm wondering if in that study, maybe that's one of the reasons that there is more bulimia seen in the cities, because people can hide it, whether, you know, even if they're in a city living in an apartment building with hundreds of other people.
Absolutely. I think that one of the speculations on why bulimia was 2.5 times higher in urban settings was that you're more anonymous in cities. It's easier to hide it. And also to hide the use of laxatives than in a small town. And in that sense, I think that smaller towns, actually I think close-knit communities like we had, we still have in some parts of the country, but we had hundreds of years ago or 100 years ago, really worked a lot better. Our upwardly mobile society where everybody's isolated and alone just has not worked very well. The other question is, some bulimics are women, middle-aged women who are living alone, moved to the cities, they're in their career, etc., and it's just much easier to hide rather than in a close-knit community. So that'll wrap it up now for our seventh podcast. Next week, we're going to have a bunch of new topics. We want to get to 20 podcasts, and we do want to hear from you. Please email us with your questions, comments, or any subjects that we can hit on at DocLarryRobbins@AOL.com, or just go on the site and click on the email.